This hour, we'll take your phone calls with Chris Alexander as we talk about horror films, so jump on board right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Chris Alexander. Chris, before we go to calls, I'm getting emails on people who want to know how to sign up for the Fear on Film course.
Right, it's definitely worth repeating, so let's do it. So you just go to www.fearonfilm.ca. That's www.fearonfilm.ca, and it'll tell you everything you need to know about the course, topics that we'll talk about, and it'll give you a direct line, a direct link to sign up. It starts this Tuesday, March 8th. It runs for 7 weeks from 7 p.m. Eastern till 9 p.m. Eastern every Tuesday.
So
7 weeks.
You've worked with Nicolas Cage before, haven't you?
Yeah, I've known. Yes, I have. I've been on your show before, and I've told my crazy Nick Cage stories. But Cage is, when I was running Fangoria, one of the first things I did was reach out to my heroes, and say, hey, listen, I'm doing this now. Let's do some stuff. And I became friendly with Nick Cage because, to me, Cage had always been, even though I hadn't starred in a lot of horror films, Vampire's Kiss being one of them, crossover stuff like Wild at Heart, David Lynch's Wild at Heart. But I always felt that he was like the modern German expressionist horror film actor. And turns out, he is a huge horror movie fan, so he flew me to his island at the Bahamas for lunch. And I'm like, the master's calling, I'm going to go. And we sat on his porch, and he had laid out all these horror movies all over the place. And he's like, I just want to talk to you about horror movies, Chris. We want to talk about Hammer horror movies and Vincent Price. And I'm like, well, let's do it.
He's a great actor.
He's a great actor, and he sacrificed a snail. He wanted to eat the snail's penis. And the story is insane. Like, the man is a madman, but a wonderful madman. Stayed friends with him, threw a party with him in New York, and known him for years. And friendly with his brother. Now, lo and behold, years later, Cage is starring in a lot of horror movies and is now truly a legitimate above board master of horror. If you don't believe me, watch a little movie called Mandy and another one called Color Out of Space, two films where he does the Cage thing, but in the context of a really crazy cosmic horror movie.
And he's got this great look on his face, doesn't he?
Yeah. He kind of looks like, I was watching Stir Crazy with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor the other day. Now, it struck me that Cage and Gene Wilder must have been separated at birth. There's kind of the same kind of look they got. This kind of hangdog kind of face, this wounded look to them that suits all genres perfectly. That's the thing about Cage. He can flit in and out of multiple genres, from family films to, hardcore horror films. And he pulls it off.
Wasn't Gene Wilder in Willy Wonka?
Yeah, Gene Wilder was Willy Wonka in the best adaptation of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, absolutely.
That was supposed to be a really dark film that apparently a lot of people didn't see, but it was there. There was an undertone. Did you get that?
It's written by Roald Dahl, who the book was, who did write horror stories for adults. You ever read Lamb to the Slaughter, like short horror stories? He had a TV show called Tales of the Unexpected, too, in the late 70s, which was adapting all his horror stuff. And he flitted with children's literature, mostly for the sake of his children, and just so happens to be that's what we remember him for. But Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in the book and in that film, that is dark. I mean, here's this crazy guy. You go to his crazy factory. He's a shut-in. He's got dwarves for slaves. He has chocolate rivers. And he basically, in succession, kills the children. I mean, it's not the subtext is not subtext. It's right there. It's pretty perverse, really, when you frame it differently.
Great music.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's fantastic. Everything about that movie is perfect. Tim Burton remade the movie many years later with Johnny Depp. Well made, well directed, but not a hair on the back of the original 71 film.
Yeah, exactly. Sammy Davis Jr. ended up singing that song that was from that movie, Candyman. And
of course.
He hated it in the beginning until he saw how many records he was selling. Then he liked it all of a sudden.
Well, that's funny how money does that to you. It can change your tune, literally in this case, change your tune very quickly.
Great song. Let's go to the phone. Scott, Tampa, Florida, first-time caller to get us started. Hey, Scotty.
Hey, George. Finally got to talk with you and get in a Southern Youper here.
Perfect.
You know... you guys talking about Gene Wilder, Young Frankenstein. I know it's a spoof on horror movies, but what a great, great film that was. And then you're talking about an all-star cast, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Lon Chaney Jr., Bela Lugosi, and, of course, in the end, not really appearing, Vincent Price.
Yep.
Just really great horror movie spoofs. So, anyway, thank you, George. I appreciate it.
Listen, before you go, you bring up a good point about, first of all, Young Frankenstein. Sure, it's a spoof, but it's filmed in black and white, so it looks like a James Whale horror film. And Mel Brooks used the same electronic devices from the Universal backlot that were used in the 1931 Frankenstein. So that gear is the same gear, you know. So, I mean, yes, it's a spoof, but it's a loving spoof and a loving homage to those true blue Golden Age horror films.
Favorite line, Abby Normal.
Abby Normal, yeah, Marty Feldman, God rest him.
What a great actor he was. What a look, too.
For those eyes. He had the Don Knotts syndrome with the thyroid condition that gave him those great bulgy eyes, you know.
What was the name of the woman who just passed away about a year or two ago? Clovis Leachman, right?
Clovis Leachman, and then prior to that, too, there's another girl, Madeline Kahn, is also in that film. We lost more than a few years ago. But and Gene Wilder, the only one I think left, and Peter Boyle's dead, too. The only one left, I think, is Mel Brooks, and he's pushing 100. And seemingly doing fine.
Okay, next up, Scott in Mount Vernon, Washington. Welcome to the show. Hey, Scott.
Why, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I believe Cary Grant is still alive from Young Frankenstein as well.
Yes.
You are correct. Yes. Okay. Rolling the hay.
And I was going to bring up the point that Mel Brooks did use the original, some of the original equipment. But I just want to say real quick, I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening to you for like 18 years. I work nights and commute. So I love your show.
Thank you.
Guest, I just want you to know that there's a kinship. There are very few people that I know that I can talk horror movies with. I'm 61 years old, been doing this a while. And I just wanted to bring up, the first earliest horror movie I saw was Edison's Frankenstein. Do you recall that one?
Yes. Yes, and you know what? That's funny. If you go back and watch that, because it was restored in the last decade or so. There was always clips here and there, but you go on YouTube, it's free and easy to find the Edison 1910 one reel of the 13-minute film of Frankenstein. And whether you buy it as a horror film, it's irrelevant as a historical piece, but there's some real ingenuity on there. The creation of the monster is stunning. They're done with puppets and transitions and fire and smoke. And that was, that's funny. That film, they went out of their way in 1910 to try to tell people that this is a fantasy. It's not a horror film. It's innocuous. But this began a longstanding trend with that film of critics being afraid of horror films and dismissing them and saying that they were going to somehow seduce the innocent in a negative way. So it was kind of in its time, a kind of a dangerous movie in many respects. But it still holds up as far as a piece of great cinematic ingenuity and imagination.
Yeah, of history as well. Another movie, an elder movie, was Peter Lorre, who was great as well, was M. That was a very, very intense movie.
Yeah, 1930, Fritz Lang, M. Peter Lorre playing the child murderer. I think Fritz Lang's first sound film. I think it was originally meant to be silent, but it's a sound film. And it is absolutely, it's Fritz Lang, one of the great filmmakers of all time. So
right.
Visually, it's a masterpiece. Exactly. But Dark as Night, and Lorre is terrifying.
Super. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate you being part of the program. Terry Garr is the aunt of one of our weekend hosts, Lisa Garr.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. I'm a huge, huge Terry Garr fan. Another movie I love. And when you watch enough horror films, you start to kind of bleed out of what was considered a horror film. You find horror in other genres. And a film that is not a horror movie, but I find to play like a horror film is Martin Scorsese's After Hours. 1985, about a guy that gets trapped in Soho for one night and can't get out through a series of misadventures. But Terry Garr is in that. She's one of the shining stars in that film, playing a crazy, proto-hippie beatnik waitress. And she's always magnificent. She was just one of the great comedy actors.
Next up, we've got Jesus in California. Welcome to the show. Hello, Jesus.
Good evening, gentlemen. A short statement and a question. I like I know it's not, I mean, it's banned in some countries, murder set pieces. And one of the reasons I thought it was so creepy is it was filmed in 8mm, and I know he's a foreign director, but I thought that was one of the creepiest movies. And it was the cinematography, you know, with the 8mm, it just made it so creepy. But the other thing is I wanted to know, with a guest, do you find that that people are more fascinated with like a Dracula or a Frankenstein, or with you know, the evil of people, like it being so horrible? I thought Rob Zombie did an excellent cover on his movies with the horror and Jason and everything. And I'm excited to want to see all your movies. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. No, I mean, you're asking what I find scarier. I mean, again, it's totally subjective. And you know, to love this stuff is to love all of it, to study all of it. And there's, I watch things for different reasons. You know, I won't pop up something like, you know, Lars von Trier's Antichrist or even one of the Nasty Rap Zombie movies on a Sunday afternoon when I want a little cheery time, you know, but I will pop up again something like Frankenstein, you know. So you watch these movies for different reasons depending on what mood you're in. And again, what scares you might not necessarily scare me. And I think that's the beauty of the genre. Everyone's going to have a different answer.
Remember those plastic models of Frankenstein and things like that? Do you remember that?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was another huge part of my life. I have an uncle, and he is, he's slow. He's slow, but in many respects, he's a savant in that he was an expert collector and an expert model maker and an expert artist. And he, in many respects, tuned me into the stuff accidentally, because he had a shrine in my grandmother's house to monsters. And he had all the Aurora model kits. He had one model in particular. It was called, and I forget who made it, but it was called, if you know this stuff, you'll know, the legendary Big Frankie. And that was a knee-high Frankenstein monster model kit. And he had this thing sitting at the top of the stairs. And I was always daring myself to go even near the threshold of his room so I could see Big Frankie. And I'll never forget that. And then when I was a little bit older, and I guess he was purging some stuff, he gave me his Big Frankie. So that was a big thing. Of course, I broke it within minutes because I was too young to care about this, but to care for it. But the models were a huge deal for me, not because I collected them, but because I would observe them with fascination and fear on my uncle's shelf.
I collected them, Chris. Let you and I go through, see how many we can recall. Ready? You go first. The models.
Oh, the models. I see. Again, I'm not an aficionado of the models, but I remember there was that series of them that were quite nasty. One was Vampirella, of course, and I think that was opened up a couple doors for me when I was a kid, maybe a proto-sexual awakening to before I even understood that.
We had Frankenstein.
Yeah, Frankenstein, and there was the Bela Lugosi Dracula. No,
Dracula, the Wolfman.
The Wolfman. Do you remember one with a girl in a cage? There was some mad scientist, and there was like a caged woman.
I remember that. And the Creature from the Black Lagoon, remember that one?
Listen, Creature is my favorite monster aesthetically. I am surrounded right now as I speak to you in the place where there is Creature from the Black Lagoon. I have large Mego dolls. I have small ones. I have masks. I am a Creature freak. So the Creature is a huge deal.
Now today,
that model was cool.
It was great. Today we would have had Bigfoot. They didn't have him in those days.
No, I mean, because what was Bigfoot? At that point, maybe it was just the famous Bigfoot shadow in the woods thing. How could you make anything out of that? I mean, now it was until years later we started having movies where you could actually see what maybe Bigfoot might have looked like.
And all they talked about in those days was the abominable snowman in the Himalayas.
Yes. There's actually a great Hammer horror movie with Peter Cushing. I think it's probably the first examination on screen of the abominable snowman from 1957.
The horror film that creeps me out is the old black and white Nosferatu. That is the ugliest looking vampire guy I've ever seen.
That's Max Schreck in F.W. Murnau's 1922 Nosferatu.
He's creepy.
It's funny you mentioned that, because Nosferatu, I think either today or yesterday, was its 100th birthday, believe it or not.
Really? 100 years?
Yeah, 100 years. And you know, the story, you know this story, but for the sake of the people, your listeners, that don't, the story behind Nosferatu is fascinating, because Murnau, who was a celebrated German filmmaker of the Expressionist period at the time, wanted to adapt Dracula. and Dracula being a relatively new novel in the sense it was written in the late 1800s, and we're talking about 1922. So his widow, Stoker's widow, was still alive. So Murnau tried to court Stoker's widow to get the rights to the novel so he could make this picture. And she was all for it, except she wanted an exorbitant amount of money. And Murnau did not have that money and probably wouldn't have spent it if he did. So he politely declined and went his own way. And back in his corner thought, you know, forget this. I can do this. I'll just change the names to protect the guilty. And Dracula will now become Count Orlok. Instead of being a suave Romanian nobleman, he'll be this bald, rat-fanged fiend with long talon nails. And I'll change it up a little bit to take place in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. And no one will notice. I'll call it Nosferatu. And he did, and the film was released to great acclaim until Stoker's widow got wind of it, saw a screening of it, and said, uh-uh, that's my husband's novel, and sued the pants off the production company and won. And the judge ordered every print of Nosferatu to be destroyed, to be burned,
wow,
to be annihilated. And they were, except for the ones that Murnau quietly snuck out of the country. And it wasn't until years later, you know, people had stills of Max Schreck standing in that doorway to document that this film had existed. But it wasn't until like the late 1950s or early 60s when I believe there was some television horror host ended up getting a 16 millimeter print.
What
did screen on late night, and that's the first time people actually saw Nosferatu.
What did you think of the writer Anne Rice, who's passed away, and her works?
You know, Anne Rice's impact on horror can't be, you know, not enough great things can be said about her. When I was a teenager, I loved Anne Rice's books because they're very, you know, they were very passionate and they humanized the monster. And that's what the best horror films do. They humanize the fiend.
Yes. Make you understand
the bad and the bad and the good. Right. So these were vampire heroes. Now, this is what she did was nothing new. If you harken back to one of my favorite TV shows of all time, Dark Shadows. Look at Barnabas.
Oh, my sister loved that. Barnabas Collins and all that stuff. Quentin Collins.
But what that did is it humanized the monsters, made us love Barnabas. We loved this guy, and I still do. My God.
What time was that on? 4 o'clock, basically?
You're asking the wrong guy, and I'll tell you why, because that show came out in 67, 68, ran until about 1970, 71. And again, I wasn't born until 74. When I saw it, it was with my great-grandmother when she babysit me. ABC started to rerun it at noon when I was about 4 or 5. So I used to have lunch there and watch Dark Shadows with her, and she was British. And I remember her shivering. Well, every time Fred came on screen, of course, everybody, all the ladies loved Jonathan Fred, but they were afraid of him. And she'd, through gritted teeth, say, "Ooh, that wicked Barnabas, I'll never forget it." But, you know, I never saw it in its first run. It was the second run. And then the director, Dan Curtis, made 2 feature films spun out of that series, The House of Dark Shadows and
yeah.
Dark Shadows.
Yeah, no, they did
which
well.
Which stand as my favorite, 2 of my favorite films of all time.
Chris, we're going to take a break and come back and take final calls with you in a moment here on Coast to Coast. Don't forget his website, fearonfilm.ca, CA because it's Canada, fearonfilm.ca. We'll be back in a moment with final calls. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with our final segment with Chris Alexander. As we talk about horror films, let's go right back to the calls. West of the Rockies, Tim is with us in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Tim.
Hey, George. How are you doing tonight?
Wonderful. Hope you are, too.
Thank you for the continuing education.
Absolutely. We're all learning. Even I am.
Mr. Alexander, thank you for being on the show tonight. This is right up my alley. Astronomy, physics, and horror movies are my favorite subjects. That's why I love Coast to Coast.
I love it. There is a theme there for sure.
Yeah, I was just on hold with Tommy, and I mentioned I had some of those models of the Wolfman, Frankenstein, and Dracula, and the cool ones were the head and the hands would glow in the dark when you shut the lights off. Those were the
best. Weren't there optional? Like you it came with the glow in the pieces. You could have the ones that you painted, or you could use the glow. Wasn't there? Weren't they optional? Am I wrong?
Well, I was really young at the time. All I know is I had the top three: the Frankenstein, Dracula, and the werewolf.
If you still had them, they'd be worth a fortune too.
Oh, wouldn't they though? Wouldn't they?
My gosh!
I was born in '66, so. The first horror movie that I saw was the George Romero Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I mean, listen, Night of the Living Dead, George was a really close friend of mine. He moved to Toronto in 2004, and I, my greatest memory is going over there every other weekend and drinking scotch with him and just asking him the questions I wanted to ask, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
He actually, before I was the first guy to speak at his funeral, so it was a bittersweet moment, but he actually made a statue of him holding my severed head, which I have on my mantle. It's pretty wild, man. Amazing. Yeah, so if you email me off my site, chrisalexanderonline.com, I'll send you a photo of it. It's pretty cool. I collect 16mm films, okay? So forget DVDs, forget all that nonsense. That's nonsense. I collect films, and I have a print of Dawn of the Dead, but I also have a print of Night. And I watch Night. I guess last year I popped it up, started running it, and I was too terrified to finish it. You know, and I'd seen it 1,000 times, but when you actually sit there alone in your little theater and you're projecting that nightmarish 1968 film, which again cost nothing to make, it was filmed on news, you know, old newsreel footage or film stock, you know, garbage looking film, but it is, it has a power, primal power that's still to this day, you know, it's 50, 60 years later, it still can't be touched. It's still a harrowing experience.
Great stuff. Tim, thanks for your call. Remember the old Japanese horror films?
Yeah, what are you talking about in the 1950s? You're talking about the kaijus, the giant monsters rising, Godzilla and all his buddies? You're talking about those
that, and remember the show, the movie, The Mysterians?
Yes, of course, The Mysterians and Ultraman and all that wild stuff. You know, the Japanese stuff is cool because I guess this exemplifies, again, what we were talking about earlier on the show about horror films literally rearing their heads and finding their apexes of popularity during times of strife or socio-political upheaval. But Godzilla, which is ground zero for the Japanese giant monster horror film.
Well, I was told by the because of the two atomic bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that the Japanese, as they got into films, started doing films about what could happen with disasters. And they made these monsters.
Yeah, well, that's the original Godzilla, which was, you know, Gojira, which actually means terrible whale, and oddly was translated to Godzilla. But, Godzilla is basically a dinosaur that has been slumbering for, you know, centuries in Tokyo Bay under the ground, and it's the bomb. It's the atomic bomb testing, or the, you know, Hiroshima bomb, which wakes that bastard up. And he's, you know, later on, Godzilla became cuddly and a friend to all children in those films. But in the initial Godzilla, he's a hell on earth, and he lays waste to everything in his path. So it's basically a kind of retribution comeuppance for our fiddling around with nuclear power.
Wasn't there a black and white movie about the giant ants?
What are you talking about? Them.
Them, that's it.
Yeah,
that
them.
Is it.
Again, we... You know, I, my kids, God bless them, were raised on this stuff. And my middle son said, Dad, you know, you keep telling us this is the scariest movie. This is the scariest movie. It doesn't quite, you know, we don't buy it anymore, Dad. So they're kind of desensitized. But to me, them, again, 1954, you don't really see the ants until the end. For the first part of the film, all you do is hear that unholy sound they make, and you see the aftermath of what they brought. But I still find them, with James Whitmore, to be a terrifying film.
I have something that you would probably love, a letter from Ray Bradbury.
Really? Well, what was the context of that? I'm curious.
I wrote an editorial years ago. We had a little news magazine called After Dark, and I was talking about the script he wrote for The Twilight Zone called I Sing the Body Electric.
Yes.
And it was about a family whose mother died, little boy, little girl, father. The mother died, and he went to the robot store and bought a nanny robot. And the whole concept was the nanny robot took care of these kids. They grew up. They became adults. And it was time for her to move on to another family with more kids. But Bradbury did that. So I did an editorial story about his script. And I was just reading it tonight, as a matter of fact. He said, this has thrilled me beyond anything I could ever get thrilled about.
And that was, you know, Bradbury, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, these were all writers that hung around in California, what they called the California Sorcerers. They were the guys that all kind of, it was a gentleman's club, and they'd all kind of write all these great science fiction stories. And
And Matheson and Beaumont were, outside of Rod Serling, were the most prolific writers in the zone. But Bradbury, I think that was the only episode he ever contributed.
I think so, too, and it was a home run.
Yeah, it was the only one. I that's one of the gentler Twilight Zone episodes, and I appreciate that one very much. It's not one of the twist in the tale scary ones. It's more of a melancholy, kind of a lovely tale.
A lot of Serling scripts that he wrote, he was in his pool dictating into a dictaphone, and his secretary would transcribe it.
Yeah, well, later on, sure. I mean, The Zone, for those of you who don't know, Serling was an Emmy Award-winning writer, right? And he wrote Requiem for a Heavyweight. I considered a very serious writer at that dawn of when television was a pretty inventive, innovative medium. And, he kept writing about racism war and the sponsors,
nobody wanted it. It was too heavy.
No, it was too heavy. So you can't sell detergent to housewives and then have all this heavy stuff. So they would be kept censoring him. And so the Twilight Zone was his way to say, okay, well, I want to say whatever I want to say, but I'm going to cheat a little bit.
He's going to hide it.
To CBS. Yeah, I'm going to hide it and coat it in science fiction and horror sugar so that people kind of get tricked into, seeing all these messages that I'm trying to convey. It was pretty ingenious. And he held that, there's a great Mike Wallace interview with him where right to the bitter end, he said, no, I'm not trying to say anything. There's no subtext here. These are just great science fiction horror stories.
Yeah. David in Ottawa, Canada. Hello, Dave. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to get the opinion on a Canadian fellow. Now, his last name was Massey. There were two Masseys. There was Vincent and Raymond. I think Vincent was the Governor General of Canada, and Raymond was the actor. He would have been a contemporary of Boris Karloff and those fellows around that period. In fact, Massey was at the tail end of radio and moving into the TV and movie thing. So what was your opinion of him? He's got a wonderful voice, that kind of
voice. He played Perry Mason, didn't he?
It was Raymond Burr played Perry Mason.
Raymond Burr, okay.
Yeah, you're Raymond Massey. Is that what you're saying, Raymond Massey?
Yeah.
Things to come, wasn't that one of the pictures? Yeah, I don't, you got me, man, because I'm not, my fellow countryman has got me, because I really don't have an opinion either way. It's not a performer I'm particularly familiar with, my Canadian brother. Sorry about that.
Oh, I remember him. He went to the University of Toronto, died in 1983, but he was in a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff, indeed.
Well,
great
well,
actor, it, too.
I'll say this about, loving this stuff. Life is a classroom. And I sometimes with bravado say that I know everything about every film, a horror film ever made. And as I age, I'm like, well, you're an idiot. Don't say that, because you're constantly learning and absorbing new information. And I just appreciate the fact that I'm kind of absorbing something as we speak. So thanks for the micro education. I'll look them up and do a little more research. Next time I'm on, I'll be an aficionado.
He was in 191 episodes of Dr. Kildare.
Wow. Okay.
He was a Man from U.N.C.L.E. He was on that. He was all over the place. He was a good actor. Good actor.
Prolific actor.
Joe, Long Island, New York. Take it away, Joseph.
Hey, Chris, two quick questions. One was, do you see sometimes where they'll put a horror movie where it'll be a posh background to start with rather than initially a horror setting like The Night of the Living Dead, where it will be an island where it's like posh and everybody's doing well, and then the horror comes in, and it's a bigger contrast. And my other question would be about, some of the actors may be taking a chance. Like, there was 9 deaths associated with The Omen, and the actor in the original picture of Dorian Gray, after he played that part, the guy was jinxed.
We're talking about George Sanders.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
From the portrait picture of Dorian Gray. George Sanders, well, that was Dorian Gray was in the 40s, so he kept rocking it. He was one of the, still, I mean, when you look at old, I just bought a 16 film that he was in, a 16 millimeter print of a British film music called The Whole Truth, and he owned the film as soon as it's on screen. But Sanders ended up, I wouldn't say jinxed, really, the film that actually kind of jinxed Sanders was one of his last films. That was an awesome horror, British trash horror movie called Psychomania, but a bunch of bikers that make a deal with the devil. If they commit suicide, they come back as living dead bikers. Jeez. And a great soundtrack by John Cameron, who worked with Led Zeppelin a lot. But George Sanders plays a butler in that. He's actually the devil. And apparently he was so bummed out by the state of his career and the nadir being psychomania that he wrote a suicide note shortly before the film was released and just offed himself quietly.
For real?
I'm done. For real. He goes, I have nothing left to give.
Jeez.
So he went out with a bang, psychomania, and that was the end of our friend, the great British actor, George Sanders.
Paul, Jersey City, New Jersey. Hello, Paul. Take it away.
Well, good morning, and bonjour, mon frère Canadien, Chris. Mm-hmm. good morning, yes. my brother Canadian, as well, because I also reside in the GTA.
Merci beaucoup.
Anyway, there is just so much I could say here. Raymond Massey was in a horror episode of Night Gallery.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Which one? I like Night, and Night Gallery stacked up against Zone is always the lesser. Although I've appreciated Night Gallery more recent years as being more of a great psychedelia piece. But which episode?
It was an episode where he collected people in cages, among them Amelia Earhart. Mickey Rooney was in that episode.
Yes, okay, I remember the episode, absolutely. Okay, yeah. It's coming a clearer picture of Raymond Massey forming in my skull. Yeah.
And by the way, his family owned Massey Ferguson.
Really? That's him?
Yeah. Yes, that was him.
Huge.
That was his family, Massey Ferguson.
Farm implement company.
You've had two Canadian callers back-to-back that have schooled me in a serious way of this, Raymond. I feel like a failure as a Canadian. I genuinely do. I've flunked. I have a lot of learning left to do. So, yes, thank you, Raymond Massey. I've definitely got to do a deep dive on this gentleman.
He was actually in two episodes. Two episodes, indeed, of Night Gallery. And what did you think of the blockade, Mr. Canadian?
of the convoy?
Yeah.
Are we going to go there, George? Do you want to take me there? Look, I'm all about freedom of speech, and I'm all about making your own opinion.
And no mandates.
How you want to live your life. Yes, yes, no mandates. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. I think the mandates were on their way out anyway, so I think it became something a little bit more distorted than what the original intent could be. I'll say this about it, George, because I don't personally gravitate too hard towards these things because they're so fleeting. Today's drama is tomorrow's anecdote. But I'll say it made for some really great theater.
It made for a lot of great theater. Anyways, yeah. Joe Long Island, thank you, Joseph. Always appreciate your phone calls. We have time to squeeze in one quick question. Vicky in Savannah, Georgia. Go ahead, Vicky.
Hello, it's Vic, George.
Oh, Vic, okay.
Great show. What I was wondering was I'd like your guest's opinion on two of what I consider the scariest scenes in all of horror movies. One is from 1956, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
After all the excitement, when Kevin McCarthy is holding in his arms his beautiful girlfriend, Donna Winter, and he looks in her eyes and realizes she's not a human being.
Ooh.
It is absolutely terrifying, and it's the way her eyes open up. It's a great piece of acting.
It was
wordless.
Excellent.
And it's
a total wonderful drama.
And what was the other one, Beck?
The other one was in the original Alien, when John Hurt's laying down and the small little alien pops out and none of the actors were aware of what was going to happen. Blood spews on Veronica Cartwright. She practically passes out. The expressions on the actors are amazing because they were all terrified.
All impromptu stuff.
Yeah, well, they knew that something, they just didn't know it was going to happen. I interviewed Veronica about that, and she definitely concurred that they knew that that was going to be a scene to happen. It was scripted, but they did not know it was going to happen then. It was a setup, so the squibs blew. And so, yes, she is. If you're going to watch that scene to see that trick in motion, you got to watch Veronica's face.
Hey, Chris, as we wrap this up, tell us about your March 8th program again.
Fear on Film, man. It is the history of horror films through my lens, the history of cinema through the distorted lens of horror, and it starts March 8th, virtually offered out of Canada's film school, Sheridan College. You can go to fearonfilm.com.
Zoom.ca. Sign up anywhere in the world as long as you have Zoom, and you can join the class. March 8th, 7 weeks from 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. Eastern, and I'll see you in class.
Super. Thanks, you, Chris. Always welcome on the show. Up next, Open Lines.